Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the third lecture in the 2012 Nature of Things lecture series. I'm Sarah George, the Executive Director of the Natural History Museum of Utah, and I want to thank you all for joining us here at the Downtown Library, Salt Lake City Main Library, this evening. We also want to welcome the audiences listening tonight on KCPW Public Radio, 88.3 and 105.3 FM. We really appreciate the work that KCPW does getting the word out to the community as our media partner and enabling people who can't physically attend to listen to the live broadcast. This is the sixth year of the Nature of Things lecture series, and we're honored to have the R. Harold Burton Foundation as our underwriting partner. We'd also like to thank Rio Tinto Kennecott Utah Copper, the Clark Foundation, the Nature Conservancy in Utah, ATK Aerospace, Myriad Genetics, Rocky Mountain Power, the Brady Foundation, and the University of Utah Department of Physics and Astronomy for their support. And I also have to give a special thank you to everybody who shops in Salt Lake County, because this lecture series is also supported by the Zoo Arts and Parks Fund. So we really appreciate that. I would ask you to see tonight's program. We have other partners, and there is a complete list of those partners in the program. We are very honored to have their support. The theme for this year's Nature of Things lecture series is sharing science stories. We developed this as a continued celebration of the opening of the Rio Tinto Center, the new home for the Natural History Museum of Utah. There, we tell scientific stories through exhibits and gallery programs. And so for this series, we assembled a group of speakers who talk about science in other ways. So far, we've heard from two scientists, Randy Olson, a scientist come filmmaker, and Brian Green, who continues to do science, but also interprets it for the public through television and books and science festivals. On April 3rd, we'll hear from the hosts of Public Radio's Radiolad, Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich, about how they interpret science. And I have to make note that no tickets are available anymore. We're completely full, but it will be broadcast on KCPW, so you can listen to it. Tonight, we are honored to have distinguished science journalist Sharon Begley with us. Sharon Begley has been the science editor, writer, and columnist for Newsweek magazine, and science columnist for the Wall Street Journal. She currently is the senior science and health correspondent for Reuters, and she's been instrumental in conveying the stories behind the science, and that is the human dramas that underlie scientific discoveries. For a sampling of her incredible work, I suggest going to the Daily Beast website, and if you look up Sharon, you can find her articles going back through 2009 on subjects that are as varied as climate change, why the Neanderthals really went extinct, the politics of science, energy, etc., etc., etc. It's remarkable. Sharon has developed a special interest in neurobiology in the last decade. This has led to the publication of several books, The Mind and the Brain in 2002 with Jeffrey Schwartz, Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain in 2007, and this year, The Emotional Life of Your Brain with Richard Davidson. Sharon has been honored for her accomplishments with an honorary degree from the University of North Carolina and, near and dear to my heart, the Public Understanding of Science Award from the San Francisco Exploratorium. Please join me in welcoming Sharon Begley.
Thank you so much, Sarah, and my deepest thanks to the Natural History Museum of Utah for inviting me to participate in your wonderful series. I'm delighted to be back in Salt Lake City. I last visited 10 years ago, which you might guess correctly, I was here to cover the Olympics for Newsweek. Great games you guys all put on, congratulations. I can't promise that the next hour is going to be as entertaining or exciting as Apollo Ono or even curling, but By the end of the evening, you'll know a few things that you didn't know at the beginning, and maybe even that you'll think about yourselves and those around you and your world in a little bit of a different way. So our topic tonight is stories about the brain. And the first story I want to tell you will speak to the two goals that I have for tonight. And I always try to do this in my talks in case people have to leave. So this is sort of the Cliff Notes version. If there's one thing I hope you take away from this evening, it's that the next time you read or hear that something in humanity, in human nature, in ourselves, is hardwired, that you just pause a second and ask whether that's really the case. And the other thing is just to reiterate the theme of the Nature of Things series. Science is a human enterprise. It's a series of stories. And I hope to tell you a few of them tonight. Whoops, wrong way. So the first story I want to tell you begins in 1935, when this little guy was born. He was born to a poor farming family in a village in Tibet. And within a couple of years, a number of high Buddhist priests had descended on the village and identified him as the 14th reincarnation of the Dalai Lama. And so he became. He was whisked away to the palace in Lhasa, where he was brought up and educated to become the Dalai Lama that we all know and love today. And when he got to the palace, there were a number of cool artifacts, tools, games, instruments that his predecessor, the 13th Dalai Lama, had received from some of the British colonial governors across the border in India. There was a telescope, there was a cuckoo clock, there were a lot of watches, other mechanical devices, and the to-be Dalai Lama was delighted with them. He would take apart the watches, and occasionally he would even put them back together. He figured out how the headlights on an old car worked. He looked through a telescope and gazed at the moon and the stars many nights. And he often says, now that he is approaching 80, if this whole, you know, leading Tibetan Buddhism and being the head of the Tibetan government in exile thing hadn't happened, he would have been a scientist or an engineer. So I mention that because this is someone who has had a deep and abiding love for science for almost his entire life, which came in handy in 1992. So we'll fast forward to 1992. Several decades before, in 1959, the Dalai Lama had to flee Tibet across the border, and he now makes his home in exile in northern India in the town of Dharamsala. So in 1992, a scientist at the University of Wisconsin named Richie Davidson had the audacity to write to the Dalai Lama and say, "I'm interested in meditation. I'm interested in what meditation can do to the brain. There are an awful lot of monks and lamas and yogis in the hills above and around Dharamsala who spend months and years in meditation. I would love to know what that has done to their brain." Well, he didn't expect his letter to be answered, but in fact it was, and the Dalai Lama invited him for an audience. So Davidson showed up in 1992 and made his pitch. He wanted to go up into the hills with the instruments at the time and measure not what the brains of the meditators were doing during the actual meditation, but rather between meditations, when they were just, you know, sitting around gazing at the landscape or chatting, because he thought that anyone who had engaged in thousands and indeed upwards of 10,000 hours of meditation, their brain was probably different than those of us who have not done that. It would be sort of like measuring or taking instruments and doing measurements on the bicep of a weightlifter. You can do that, you know, while he's lifting the weights, but somebody who has been lifting weights for a number of years, there should be an enduring effect on the muscles. And with the same sort of reasoning, Davidson wanted to see what the enduring effects on the brain might be from decades of meditation. So as I say, they got lucky. The Dalai Lama, because of his interest in science and engineering since he was a child, said, yes, I will help you. Now, even that was not all that easy. They were not at all home free. There were about 67 monks and lamas and yogis meditating in the hills above Dharamsala. The closest one was a 90-minute walk from the last dirt road. So they were not just sitting there ripe for a scientist to come calling. And in fact, there, of course, was no post office, no mail delivery, certainly no telephones. In fact, the only way they kept in touch with anyone back in the city or the town of Dharamsala was because the Dalai Lama would occasionally dispatch one of the monks working with him to make sure that these guys were all right. So they would make sort of like a circuit rider in the old American West to check up on them and bring them food. So once the way was paved, Davidson and his colleagues, his scientific colleagues, showed up in Dharamsala, hired Sherpas, because back then a computer was not the one-pound miracle that we know today, but it was, you know, pounds and pounds of stuff. They had six steamer trucks worth of instruments that they had to get up into the hills. A jeep took them to the end of the road, and then they and the Sherpas they hired to haul the seven backpacks stuffed with 60 pounds each of electronics and gear began the long climb. Finally, up ahead, they spied a stone hut. That's where they found one of the most experienced meditators of the 10 that the Dalai Lama had suggested they would have the most luck with. This was a gentleman in his 60s who had been meditating for more than 40 years. However, he was in failing health, and when the scientists explained to him what they hoped to do, they wanted to put wires and instruments on his head, they wanted to give him psychology tests, he did not exactly embrace this mission. He instead explained that his own meditation practice was mediocre at best, something that he attributed to a gallbladder problem, and that if the scientists wanted to learn the effects of meditation, they should just meditate themselves. So they moved on to the second monk. In this case, the problem was other scientists. This monk had had a friend, a renowned yogi, who had traveled to Harvard Medical School for what scientists there promised would be non-invasive studies. But the Harvard researchers had drawn his blood, and 3 months after his return to Dharamsala, he passed away. The monk was certain the scientist meddling had killed his friend. And another thing, he told them over what became a 3-hour debate, it makes no sense to try to measure the mind, which is formless and non-physical. If they did succeed in measuring anything, he said, it would be completely unimportant in terms of understanding the effects of meditation. So that's how it went through monks 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all the way through 10. This is what we called a failed experiment. The scientists gave up. They trekked back to Dharamsala. They had another audience with the Dalai Lama. They explained that they had failed. The Dalai Lama expressed his commiseration with them and said, you know, what if you tried again, also with long-term practitioners, but this time, those who had traveled to the West and are familiar with Western technology, so that when they see the oscilloscopes and the computers and the EEGs and the electrodes, they don't start talking about their gallbladders. Maybe, the Dalai Lama told Davidson, you can invite such monks to labs in America rather than test them in the field. Bonus, no more trekking up into the hills with hundreds of pounds of equipment. And the Dalai Lama promised to put in a good word with some of the adepts in his circle. Whoops, wrong way. Now we'll fast forward to the early 2000s. The Dalai Lama's interest in science continued, and he was visiting an American medical school. There, he was invited to watch a brain operation with the consent of the patient and the patient's family, and he did. And at the end, he was taken aside by the brain surgeon, and they were talking about neuroscience, one of the Dalai Lama's keen interests in the whole universe of science. And the Dalai Lama said, you know, my friends who are scientists have explained to me that all of our thoughts and feelings and perceptions, all of this stuff that comes out of our brain, the stuff we call the mind, these are all the results of chemical and physical activity in the brain. And I sort of accept and understand that, he said. But tell me, if these physical, chemical, biological things can give rise to these wondrous events that we call thoughts and emotions and the other manifestations of the mind, might it be possible that the mind can act back on the physical stuff of the brain? And the neurosurgeon smiled indulgently and said, no, of course not, it doesn't work that way. The arrow of causality points in only one direction, from the brain to the mind, and not the other way. And that reflects the best that we know from neuroscience today. So as we go on, I hope to show you that, in fact, the Dalai Lama was right and the neurosurgeon was wrong. Our topic for this evening is how the brain can change. It can change in two main ways. One is by the experiences we have. And by experiences, I mean something in the outside world. Sensory information that lands in your brain through your eyes or your ears or your fingertips, but also just the thoughts that we think. I'll get back to that in a few minutes, but let me talk first about how sensory experiences can change the brain. I always have this fantasy when I talk to people that I will have been, you know, really organized ahead of time, and I would have arranged for at least some of you to go have fMRIs at the local med school or hospital or something. And those would be the before MRIs. And then you would come and, you know, hear about all this cool research. And then I would send you home in the evening, but blindfolded. And you would spend the next week, you know, going through your daily life as best you can, maybe, you know, with a few not broken knees, but banged up knees. And then at the end of the week, I would bring you back and do an fMRI again and see how your brain has changed. Well, that's obviously not very practical, but it was done by scientists at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital, which is an affiliate of Harvard Medical School, and I call it the blindfold experiment. And it really is basically just what I described. A bunch of volunteers showed up at the hospital, and for a week, they were blindfolded, and this was a special blindfold. It had photographic film on the edges, so that if anyone cheated, the film would be exposed, and the scientists could tell, because there's just no trust in the world anymore. So to keep these wonderful volunteers from going, you know, completely crazy from boredom, they were put through a number of exercises during their week of enforced blindness. They listened to tones piped in through headphones, high and low tones, and the task was to tell which was high and which was low. Needless to say, if there's a great difference in the frequency, that's a fairly easy task. As the frequencies get closer and closer together, it becomes quite difficult. So they went through this exercise numerous times every day. They also did a tactile exercise. They used their favorite hand to read Braille, which, as you know, is a series of raised dots. Again, I think for most of us, our closest experience with Braille might be in an elevator, where, of course, the numbers usually have Braille representations as well. If you look at them and say, okay, four raised dots, three, one, whatever, that should be fairly easy. Try it sometime when you're in an elevator. It's not that easy. However, like most things in life, you can get better at it with practice. And so these volunteers practiced Braille. I won't say that they learned Braille, but they trained in it as best they could. So they had intense, repeated tactile sensation on their fingertips. And as I described, they had had an fMRI before, which had shown, not surprisingly, among other things, that the visual cortex, which is a big chunk of the brain at the back, sort of right above your hairline, before this, these were normal seeing volunteers, the visual cortex practiced, ta-da, vision. It was active when people saw things. At the end of the 5 days of enforced blindness, again, the people were put into the fMRI tube, and this time, when they heard something, again, sounds were piped into the tunnel, the visual cortex became active. When they were lying in the tube and they felt stuff, the visual cortex became active. Now, these were adults. These were not, you know, infants, certainly by any means. Adults in whom, for decades, it would be safe to say, the visual cortex had processed visual information and nothing but visual information. But after only a week of enforced blindness, when, to anthropomorphize a little bit, you could sort of imagine the visual cortex saying, huh, no signals are arriving, maybe I should change jobs. It in fact did change jobs and began processing tactile sensations and auditory sensations. The scientist who led the study said this about it: the brain's ability to reorganize itself is much greater than previously believed. Even in an adult, the normally developed visual system quickly becomes engaged to process touch or auditory signals in response to complete loss of sight. So that may sound like, you know, just sort of a cute little parlor trick or something, but I hope to persuade you in the next several minutes that it's not just a parlor trick. In fact, it's the tip of a very large and important iceberg. And the reason I say that is what's depicted here. This is the picture of the brain that dominated neuroscience for centuries. I'm sure you've seen these in magazines or textbooks. Each spot on the brain has been found to serve a particular function. And not just large-scale functions such as sight, but in some brain mapping, people have traced the region that gives rise to understanding metaphors or doing long division, or for some of us, not doing long division. Each region is assigned a function, and it was thought that this is pretty much how it is and how it always will be. The brain was thought of as a complicated machine with parts that carry out specific functions that are located in specific fixed places. And as everybody knows, machines can't alter their structure, much less grow new parts. This machine-based view of nature, the history is very interesting, but the basic idea was arose from the discoveries of Galileo and Newton that the planets move by impersonal mechanical forces, gravity, and the idea of nature as mechanism was extended to our own bodies, which also came to be seen as machines, but that's a whole nother lecture. Anyway, there were two specific dogmas related to the brain that took hold in the 19th century. One was that no new neurons are born in it once you're past childhood. And this has come down to us as the notion that, you know, we lose some number of neurons every day or every hour once we're past the ripe old age of, you know, whatever, 12, 15, 20. And once they're gone forever, and you're never going to make any new ones. And the second dogma was what is depicted here, again, that there are particular structures that go along with specific functions, and those are etched in stone. So what it all added up to is the dogma that the adult brain is fixed in structure and function. So if genes or just normal brain development dictate that, you know, that cluster of neurons will move the right hand and nothing but the right hand, that's all it's going to do. As late as 1999, a couple of scientists put it this way: we are still taught that the fully mature brain lacks the intrinsic mechanisms needed to replenish neurons and reestablish neuronal networks after acute injury or in response to the insidious loss of neurons seen in neurodegenerative diseases. So just think about that a second. And here's just another couple of examples of how it manifests itself. This shows the part of the brain that feels and the part of the brain that moves your body, the somatosensory cortex and the motor cortex. It's easier to see this way. This is the little guy, the homunculus. And the size of the different parts of the body correspond to how much brain is devoted to feeling that particular part. So, as humans, our hands are very sensitive. Actually, an easy way to see it is, so you see his tongue is quite large. If you move your tongue along the bottom of your front teeth, you can probably feel little ridges. But if you were to put like the back of your wrist against the bottom of your front teeth, you probably would not feel those ridges. And that's because the back of the hand is so small you can't even see it here, but the tongue is very large. The brain has a larger representation of the tongue than the back of the hand, and that's why the tongue is much more sensitive to tactile sensations than the hand. Anyway, so this is the homunculus. Which, you know, you can only label neurological nihilism, because just think about how, you know, discouraging, if not depressing, that is. If the brain can't change, then when someone suffers a stroke, which destroys a region of the brain, they are unlikely ever to get those functions back. If someone suffers from a mental illness, which can be traced to overactivity or underactivity or just some aberration of activity in the brain, they are unlikely to be pulled back all the way to full health. But since this is an upbeat evening, I want to tell you that, in fact, the nihilism turns out to have been unfounded. The dogma is wrong. As I said a few minutes ago, it can change in two ways. In response to signals from the outside world, sensory experience, and that's the blindfold experiment, when visual signals were not arriving at the visual cortex changed its job to handle auditory and tactile sensations. It can also change in response to internal signals. The thoughts that we think act back on the physical stuff of the brain that generated those thoughts. That's the question that the Dalai Lama asked, the one where he said, where he was told, no, that's simply not possible. So I wanted to give you just a few examples from the first category. And I'll start with stroke, just because it exacts such a terrible toll in this country. Let's see, an estimated 750,000 people suffer a stroke every year, and it's of course, a huge source of disability. Briefly, a stroke, as you undoubtedly know, can occur in a couple of ways. There can be a clot in the brain that prevents blood flow, or a blood vessel can burst. And in either case, there is just frank loss, death of neurons. But there is a scientist, and here's the next story, named Edward Taub. And he was working at a lab in Silver Spring, Maryland. And as I look out into the audience, I see that a few of you here might be old enough to remember this. He was doing experiments on monkeys, and the experiments involved cutting the nerves to some of their fingers. This is the part of tonight where we say that science is not always pretty. The distraught animals, in some cases, would gnaw off their fingers because they had no more sensation there. And again, some of you who are old enough might remember that these were the notorious Silver Spring monkeys. This was the case that gave rise to the animal rights movement in this country. It was the birth of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. But the scientist was convinced that what he was doing was for the good of humankind, especially those who had suffered from a stroke. And the reason was this. It turned out that after the monkeys had lost, let's say, a finger, the part of the brain that had been processing signals, sensory information from that finger, changed jobs, just as in the blindfold experiment. So this led Edward Taub to ask, might that be relevant to stroke? And he came up with a therapy, which is called constraint-induced movement therapy. And basically, I'll take an example where someone has had a stroke in the right motor cortex. The right motor cortex moves the left side of the body. So after my stroke, I can no longer move my left arm. In this therapy, he restrains my only now working right arm and hand in one of these slings. So I go through my day and I can't use that. To describe the arm as paralyzed, it turns out, is not always completely correct. Often there is at least a little bit of residual movement. And with intense therapy, by which I mean 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, for at least 10 weeks, people, again, under the incredible ministrations of these amazingly competent and patient occupational and physical therapists can start to move the supposedly paralyzed arm and hand again. And I'll just mention that this has been effective not only in people who recently had a stroke, but in people whose stroke was 20 years ago, at which point you would think whatever changes had happened in the brain were really locked in. After he found these clinical results, and stroke victims had in fact regained a lot of the motion in their supposedly paralyzed arm or hand, he and others began to do, again, brain imaging to see what had happened. And this is what they found. Again, in this example, my right motor cortex has had the stroke. How was my left arm moving? Several things had happened, different in different people, but they all fell into these three categories. Suddenly, the premotor cortex, which is a different part of the brain, it's slightly forward of the motor cortex, and usually its function is just to plan movements. It doesn't actually send the signals to the arm to move. Suddenly, the premotor cortex was moving the arm. Or regions adjacent to the damaged region had somehow been coaxed into moving the arm. Even more surprising was that the corresponding area in the complete other hemisphere of the brain, again in this example, now my left motor cortex, had been recruited to move the left arm. And he also found increased gray matter in areas responsible for motor skills. So this is Taub, and he puts it this way. These findings suggest the brain can recover from traumatic injury by creating new brain cells to replace those lost by injury. For years, science thought the adult brain was hardwired, that phrase again, with no ability to change or adapt. Now we have further proof of neuroplasticity, the brain's remarkable ability to respond to damage. Ideas for science experiments can come from all sorts of places. So after Taub had finished, after he had gotten these results with stroke patients, he wondered, is there anything that I can look at in people who have not suffered a trauma, but just normal, healthy people, and see if their brains might have been changed by the life they led? So he was sitting around at dinner one evening with colleagues in Germany, and his wife was with him. His wife is an opera singer, an excellent musician. And they were saying, you know, is there any activity where there's intense sensory stimulation, similar to what he was doing with the stroke patients, where we might, you know, find something interesting in the brain? And his wife, Mildred Allen, piped up, well, of course, the fingering digits in string players get an intense workout. If you're a violin player, the four fingers of your, if you're right-handed, of your left hand are the ones that, you know, dance up and down the strings, and they get an intense sensory workout. So again, standard procedure, see which regions of the brain are active when people are engaged in different activities. And in this case, they found an expansion of the motor cortex region that controls the fingering digits. And this got a lot of media attention at the time, and what most of the reporters focused on was how children, people who started to learn a musical instrument as children, had a hugely significant expansion of the motor cortex, more so than people who had taken up the instrument as adults, even young adults. But Taub thought that that was ridiculous. We should expect that the brain of a child would be much more malleable, changeable, adaptable than the brain of adults. But he focused on the fact that even adults, and these were people in their 40s and older, even they, taking up the violin at their age, they experienced significant brain changes. Again, a remapping of the motor cortex so that it increased the region that controls the fingering digits. I'll give you just one more example of sensory experience changing the brain. This is the art appreciation part of the evening. These are watercolors by a Turkish artist named Esref Armagan, who has a lovely website. He lost his sight soon after birth. And much as you would expect now that you know the blindfold experiment, when he was studied at Harvard, they found that his visual cortex was, again, not surprisingly, handling other senses. But then they found something even odder. You might be able to construct a story in which the brain's sensory regions can somehow you know, sort of trade off. And if one is no longer doing what it was originally intended to do, it can take up and help some of the others. But in this blind artist's brain, the visual cortex was also processing language. It was parsing sentences. It was determining which verbs go with particular nouns. Like if he was told hammer, he would say hit, or you know, boat, sail, etc. So there we have an example of a fairly primitive region of the brain, and the visual cortex is primitive because lots of other animals have one, somehow getting smart enough to process language. Anyway, I'll leave that one there. And now turn to the other ways that the brain can change. This is, again, how the mind can act back on the brain. The Dalai Lama's interest in science has only grown since the first interactions with the crazy scientists who wanted to study the monks up in the hills. And in 2004, he invited a number of Western scientists, as well as Buddhist scholars, to a meeting in Dharamsala, where the scientists presented some of their findings and how the brain can change. And the Buddhists also had interesting things to contribute. The overall topic was, again, can the brain change its structure and function? And in particular, can mental training change the brain? And here's our travelogue portion of the evening. Dharamsala was a British colonial hill town, so there's still some British influences there. You know, if you have a travel bent, if you arrive there, you will certainly realize that you are not in Kansas anymore. Just a really cool place to visit if any of you get a chance, and a lot easier to get to now that they have little planes. I emphasize little, but it's better than the buses that took 12 hours to get there and went around these mountain roads where you were sure you were going to fall off the side. Anyway, the Dalai Lama's interest in neuroscience generally, and in neuroplasticity in particular, arises at least somewhat from Buddhism itself. This slide tells you everything I know about Buddhism. I defer to anyone in the audience who is a Buddhist scholar or just knows a great deal about it. And I am eternally indebted to the very patient Buddhist scholars who have explained this much and more to me. But our Cliff Notes version of Buddhism for this evening includes these. Buddhism defines a person as a constantly changing dynamic stream. It teaches that we are in pain and suffering, but that we have the power to change that. It says that our activities inform who we are. As we act, so shall we become. And by detaching ourselves from our thoughts, by observing our thinking dispassionately and with clarity, we have the ability to overcome afflictions such as chronic anger. So as you look at those, I'm sure you can see why this philosophy would find resonance in the findings of neuroplasticity and the results showing how changeable the brain and the mind are. So let me give you just a few examples of how mind can change brain. The virtual piano player. Same setup. Volunteers came in, had their brains scanned to determine which regions were performing which functions. And then for the next week, half of them were trained on a keyboard. They learned a simple five-finger piano exercise, and they practiced again over and over and over. One theme I hope you're picking up is that for the brain to change, there has to be intense, repeated, focused activity. It's not like, you know, some little thing happens and the brain changes. The other half of the volunteers just imagined playing this exercise. They would look at the musical notations, and they would imagine one or another finger moving. And again, since there is no trust in this world, these volunteers' wrists and hands were instrumented so that they could not move even a muscle without the scientists knowing about it. So the end of the week rolls around, and the volunteers are going to have their brains scanned by fMRI again. Now, remember I told you that people that string players, in them, the motor cortex, the region that controls the fingering digits, had expanded. So you might say to yourself, okay, well, if people are practicing this five-finger piano exercise so intensely, even for a week, well, maybe there would be some expansion of the motor cortex, the part that controls the five digits of the right hand. And in fact, for the people who had been dutifully playing for that week, yes, this part here, the motor cortex, had indeed expanded. But what was cool was that even in the people who just thought about playing, the motor cortex had expanded just as much. After a week of only imaginary practice, the region that controls the piano playing fingers expanded just as it did in those who actually played. So any of you who are tennis players or golfers or divers, you know, this whole thing about mental practice and mental exercise, just imagine yourself smashing that overhead or putting or doing a diving turn. There's definitely something to it. This is our other detour into Buddhism because it comes up in the next example of mind changing brain. Mindfulness is a form of Buddhist meditation, and it's basically the practice of observing yourself from outside yourself, as a third party, as a disinterested observer. You are fully aware, but non-judgmental, by which I mean you'll be sitting in a quiet place, and whatever thoughts come into your head, you will note them and observe them. You'll say, for instance, I'm really bored, or here I am thinking about what's for dinner. Huh, how interesting that I'm thinking about what's for dinner. Why can't I focus better? Why can't I be a better meditator? Huh, why am I berating myself for not being a good meditator? Anyway, you are the observer. And that feeds into the next example of how mere thought, and I hope by the end of this evening no one will think of thoughts as mere anymore, but of how mere thought can change the brain. The example comes from obsessive compulsive disorder. This, of course, is the illness in which people feel compelled to check to see if something is wrong, to run back to the house because they're positive they left the stove on, or they're convinced that everything in the world is covered in germs, every doorknob in public, every everything. Or they are convinced that if they don't count cracks in the sidewalk and avoid walking on them, some terrible tragedy will befall their loved ones. Anyway, it has many manifestations, but the commonality is the brain is saying something is wrong here. And that has in fact been traced to what's called the worry circuit. It involves the amygdala, which is a big part of the emotion region, and the anterior cingulate. All of those are sort of deep in the center of the brain. The anterior cingulate seems to generate the uh-oh, the something is wrong feeling. So a scientist at UCLA, his name is Jeffrey Schwartz, had meditated himself for many years. And he wondered whether mindfulness meditation might be able to help his OCD patients. And the reasoning was, as I'm sure you can figure out, if you can somehow get people to observe these worry thoughts, maybe they can tell themselves, it's not really the case that I left the stove on. It's not really the case that if I step on this crack, something awful will happen. Because for almost every person who is suffering from OCD, a good part of them understands that these thoughts and worries they have are not real. They truly do understand that, no, I know the stove isn't on, but they are compelled to go back anyway. Anyway, so he taught them, and I'm giving you, you know, the 30-second version of this. This was a long, as it says here, 10 weeks of mindfulness meditation therapy. He taught them basically to observe these OCD thoughts from the perspective of a disinterested observer. And again, before and after, the brain scans showed that it had quieted activity in the worry circuit as much as medication did. antidepressants are often used to help people with OCD. In this case, it was Prozac. And Schwartz calls this self-directed neuroplasticity because people had practiced, they had focused on what aspect of their thoughts and therefore their brains they wanted to change, and they were able to do so. This pure mental activity had altered brain chemistry, had altered the pattern of activity in the brain in a way that was therapeutic. There are a bunch of other examples of how neuroplasticity is being harnessed to help people with mental, psychiatric illnesses, depression, dyslexia, Tourette's, a number. But I don't want you to get the idea that this is applicable only to pathological states, to problems. The obvious question is, well, can it help people who are, you know, basically okay, but maybe want to be a little different, a little better? We all have an emotional life. And that was the topic of the book that Sarah mentioned that just came out, The Emotional Life of Your Brain. And this was written with Richard Davidson, the scientist who did not have any luck trekking into the hills of Dharamsala. So here's where, you know, this was probably not a very nice slide to put in because maybe some of you didn't get dinner. But the reason the red velvet cake is here is because when Davidson talks about emotional style, he means something about how we react emotionally to the world, whether we're resilient, whether we have a positive or negative outlook, a bunch of things. And people, you know, as I would describe it to them, would ask me, well, but what about personality? Personality is the red velvet cake of the mind. And by that I mean it's a human construct. Red velvet cake actually has stuff that is found in nature, like eggs and sugar. But if you want to change your red velvet cake, if you've tasted it and it's not quite right, you got to know what's in it, what the basic real physical things in it are. And emotional style has that going for it. Each of the emotional styles that Davidson has identified can be traced back to characteristic patterns of brain activity in particular regions of the brain. So these are what he calls the six dimensions of emotional style. But it's probably easiest to give you a sense of just one of them. So just keep the answer to yourself. But I have five or so questions. It's possible to at least sort of give a self-assessment of where you fall on the spectrum of, in this case, resilience. So you're supposed to agree or disagree strongly or not strongly. If I have a minor disagreement with my spouse, that's or a close friend, and this is not, you know, a big fight, this is more like it's your turn to do the dishes, it typically leaves me out of sorts for hours or longer, gesundheit. So, you know, either you're somebody who can brush off these things or you obsess on them for the rest of the day. Question two, if another driver uses the shoulder to zoom up to the front of a long line of traffic waiting to merge, I am likely to shake it off easily rather than fume about it for a long time. This one came from my husband, anyway. When I have experienced profound grief, it has interfered with my ability to function for many months. Again, the distinguishing detail here is inability to function. Everyone suffers from grief, but again, for some people, it is truly debilitating. For others, it can be a part of your life for as long as you live, but you are able to function in the world. If I make a mistake at work and get reprimanded for it, I can shrug it off and view it as a learning experience. Again, does that characterize you or not so much? And I think the last one I threw in, if I try a new restaurant and find that the food is awful and the service snooty, it ruins my whole evening. I'm sure we've gone out with some people like that, and then there are others who, you know, say, well, you know, these things happen, but let's have fun at the movies. As I said, the dimensions of emotional style can all be traced back to patterns of activity in the brain. And they've been measured both by fMRI, those are the pretty colorful pictures that you often see showing here this part of your brain is active when it's engaged in this activity, but also by EEG, an older technology, but one that has many advantages. The resilience circuit, it turns out, has to do with the prefrontal cortex, which is right behind your forehead, and the amygdala, which is best known for generating the sense of anxiety and fear, sort of negative emotions. And the reason these two add up to the resilience circuit, it turns out, people who are very resilient, who are able to bounce back from adversity, have very strong connections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. The amygdala is sending out all of these messages, something is wrong, everything is awful, you know, that restaurant meal is the end of the world, or that guy, you know, pulling up in traffic deserves the worst that fate can send his way, etc. The prefrontal cortex, and this is the most evolved region of the brain, is saying, shut up. So when you hear that, so your first thought might be, okay, I'm not resilient. I am indeed one of these people for whom a bad meal can ruin the entire evening. I'm stuck. This is who I am. But that's not the case. As you probably could have guessed since we're talking about neuroplasticity this evening. In people who are lucky enough to be resilient, the frontal cortex has numerous and strong connections to the amygdala. But it is possible to cultivate those connections to increase their strength so that you too can become a more resilient person, if you so choose. One of the points we make in the book is that there's not one best way to be. You know, when you say resilient, well, you might think, well, of course, I want to be more resilient. But it's possible to be too resilient. I mean, just think about it. If you are never set back by, if you are not thrown back on your heels, disturbed by, you know, some of the many awful things that happen in the world and to us personally, maybe that's not the way that you want to be. So, as I say, there can be such a thing as too resilient. And it's really up to the individual where he or she wants to fall on the spectrum. But there are mental interventions to move you along either toward more or less resilient, and similarly for the other six dimensions of emotional style. So here we get back to the first story. The Dalai Lama was indeed as good as his word, and he put out the message among Buddhist scholars throughout the world, in Asia and Europe in particular, that those who were interested in science, if they wanted to lend their brains to this research, there was Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin-Madison who was welcoming them with open arms. And the first monk to volunteer is Mathieu Ricard. He is indeed French by birth. He became a Buddhist monk in the 70s, right after he got his PhD in molecular biology. So he is the perfect guy for this sort of work. He has scientific training. Not only is he not afraid of an EEG net with 256 electrodes, but he can understand scientific protocol. And he has been one of the most studied of Davidson's monks. So I want to give you just the briefest of briefest descriptions because we're coming to the end of our time. The research that Davidson has been doing is basically what he had hoped to do in 1992. Take people who are the Olympic champions of meditation, people who have upwards of 10,000 hours of meditation under their saffron robes, as it were. And 10,000 hours wasn't picked out of a hat. If you go into the literature about chess masters, or virtually anything, 10,000 hours seems to be the magic number. Once you achieve that, you are on your way to becoming one of the best in the world at that particular activity. And 10,000 hours turns out to be sort of the tipping point for meditation as well. One little thing that he looked at was whether there are regions in the brain that generate compassion and whose activity can be increased, again, for those who wish to become more compassionate. And indeed, there are brain regions that become more active when people engage in compassion meditation. The protocol here is the monk lies in the fMRI tube and turns compassion meditation on and off. Compassion meditation, again, my ignorance of Buddhism is showing, but the 15-second version is you first wish that somebody close to you be free from suffering, and then you extend that out. You extend that to maybe colleagues or friends, and then to everyone in your circle, and then finally to every living being in the world, that they should be free from suffering. That's compassion meditation. So Matthew would engage in compassion meditation for 60 seconds, and then he was told by the scientists in the control room, okay, neutral state, Matthew. And he would just make his mind go blank. Anyway, on, off, on, off. If any of you have been in a MRI tube for medical reasons, you know it's not that pleasant an experience. It's pounding, it's loud, it's claustrophobic. This is Matthew after he spent 3 hours in the MRI tube, just, you know, smiling and gracious and everything else. So that alone might make you think, yeah, there is something to this meditation stuff. Anyway, the bottom line of the compassion meditation work was that indeed brain regions that are linked to, interestingly, perspective taking and empathy seemed extra active in the brains of people who engaged in compassion meditation. The control group were novice meditators, people who had learned compassion meditation for a week or so. As you might imagine, these were the proverbial undergraduate lab rats, just, you know, people volunteering for course credit, etc. Perspective taking is interesting because true compassion, true empathy, requires you to understand, to put yourself in that person's shoes, to truly understand what he or she is suffering. And from that, empathy arises. I want to leave you with one thought from Davidson. I know I've thrown a lot of science at you this evening, but I hope this is a takeaway message. Neuroplasticity will reshape psychology. Much of psychology had accepted the idea of a fixed program unfolding in the brain, one that strongly shapes behavior, personality, and emotional states. That view is shattered by the discoveries of neuroplasticity. The message I take from my work is that I have a choice in how I react, that who I am depends on the choices I make, that who I am is therefore my responsibility. You guys have been a great audience. I very much appreciate it, so thank you. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to give it a try.
Thank you, Sharon. You're listening to the Natural History Museum of Utah's The Nature of Things on KCPW 88.3 and 105.3 FM in Salt Lake City. We will have two microphones, one going up each aisle, and Sharon can take some questions. Raise your hand and a microphone will come to you.
Sir.
Hi, Sharon. Thank you for coming here. I have a question. If the doctors, you know about the strokes that are happening, why they don't find the reason of why those strokes happen in people? And then they get all the therapy, you know, going and on and on and on, and it takes so long, and it's like never discovered, you know, like cure of cancer. Why is that happening? And how can you explain that?
The reasons for stroke, I think they're actually making some progress on, but I think you've hit on something very important, namely the disconnect between how patients are treated after a stroke and what the science has shown. My mother had a stroke a few years ago, and she was offered rehab that basically took an hour a day. That's not going to do it. And it's very rare to find a rehab place that will do even 3 hours a day, let alone the 6 to 8 hours that has been shown to truly remodel the brain. Taub often says that his research, he was not eligible for NIH funding for many years. The American Stroke Association said that what he was finding was impossible, that any recovery from stroke was most likely just a reflection of a diminution of inflammation or of swelling, that there was not true remapping of the brain. You know, we all wish that science worked the way it seems to in the textbooks, that something is found and replicated and verified. We don't want people to act on, you know, a single experimental finding, but this has been replicated and verified by a number of groups. I don't think I want to wade into the morass of the American healthcare system here and reimbursement and what insurance companies will pay for. All I can tell you is that, yes, out in the world, if you are a stroke victim, you'll be very lucky to find the kind of intense therapy that has been shown to be most likely to help you. Sir.
Has there been any study done recently to show the brain's ability, like the heartbeat and the control of atrial fibrillation in a heartbeat? Can the control mechanisms of the brain actually, if stimulated by meditation, change the heartbeat to function better? Do you know anything about that?
Heartbeat is actually one of the easier ones. The connections between the emotional circuits in the brain and, you know, stuff below the neck are very, very strong. Meditation, numerous forms of meditation, have been shown to reduce blood pressure and lower heart rate. Atrial fibrillation specifically, I do not know, I'm sorry. But there have also been studies showing a connection between emotional state and asthma, for instance, and people have been trained to dial down the activity in the region called the insula, which is connected to how reactive your airways are. So the idea that our emotional life impacts our health is, you know, has been shown over and over again. I don't know how widely known it is, but I think it's safe to say, and, you know, not to keep beating up on American healthcare, but if you or your child show up at the doctor's office with asthma, I think it's quite rare for the physician to suggest any kind of mental, psychological intervention. You know, it's not reimbursed, or they don't believe it, or something else might be going on. Yes?
When they're looking, when there's damage and the brain rewires, are new cells grown or are current cells recruited and then expand in size?
Door number two. The brain, it turns out, does generate new neurons. Even old brains into the 60s and 70s, especially in a region that has to do with memory, and those cells, the discovery that there is, it's called neurogenesis in the brain, that happened in 1998, and subsequently research has shown that those new cells are able to insinuate themselves into functional circuits, and it might indeed be one of the reasons, or one of the ways that you can keep your memory sharp as you get older. But the kind of remapping that we've been talking about, where a particular region gets larger or something gets switched, that does not have to do with making new neurons. Instead, it seems to reflect the fact that the brain has just amazing redundancy. You know, talk about an external hard drive. The brain is backed up in more ways than you can imagine. And let's just take the example of increasing the region that controls you know, the fingers in a musician. You'd think, well, that must be crowding out something. But no, somehow there's room for expansion to take place, not at the expense of anything else. Again, there's just extra room in there, which sort of makes you think, well, how much better could we be if we used it all? Anyway. Yes, up there.
Is the study of neuroplasticity bringing us any closer to an understanding of either what the conscious experience is, or at least what level of complexity, or what type of phenomena are necessary to generate this experience of that we have? Maybe it's an illusion of being aware of our existence.
Okay, so I'll try this exercise. Let's say the neuroscientists knew down to the neuron what caused you to see the color red. And they explained that photons of a particular wavelength entered your retina, and they wended their way back to the visual cortex and then through a way station in the thalamus and blah, 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 and that's how you see red. And let's say you're a colorblind person and you read this example, you read this explanation rather. Do you think you would now have a subjective conscious experience of red just by knowing how it arose? I mean, I would say the answer is no. There's something subjective about consciousness that it, at least so far, no amount of breakthroughs in neuroscience has been able to touch. I mean, it's a long-standing philosophical problem, of course, but the hard problem of consciousness, what gives rise to our felt experience, if that's indeed what you mean by consciousness, as opposed to, you know, under anesthesia, as opposed not. But this very inchoate thing called consciousness, how do you feel the world, your experience of red, your experience of happiness or whatever, that has so far eluded science. If you mean specifically awareness, there has been greater progress, especially by studying what happens during general anesthesia and which regions of the brain are quiet in that experience or also sleep. That, to me at least, is less interesting than this, you know, amazing thing called consciousness. And as I say there, again, the philosophers might have made more progress than the neuroscientists, at least so far.
Hi.
Yes.
My grandpa just had a stroke, and I've been sitting with him through all the therapy and everything, and today he seemed to kind of shut down mentally after an hour. And I was wondering, is there a certain age or even just where exhaustion kicks in that 6 hours would be too much for him, or?
It's certainly possible. Any kind of therapy like that has to be individualized. You know, maybe there are ways to keep his spirit up, both physically and emotionally. And 6 hours, it could be that he doesn't need 6 hours a day. But certainly after it becomes counterproductive, I mean, I would imagine that the rehab team would be smart enough not to keep pushing it. But, you know, I mean, there have been so many studies looking at how important, you know, emotional and psychological support is for people, especially those who are hospitalized or in a rehab center or a nursing home, if they have hope, if you know, they understand all the people who love them and care for them and are rooting for them. I mean, those things have real tangible manifestations in the brain and can sometimes, you know, really do wondrous things. I mean, you look young enough that I'm guessing your grandfather is not very, very old. Okay, well, again, individuals are individuals. And the only thing I can say is, you know, don't give up and do everything you can to keep him from giving up. 90 is not too old. 90 is the new 60. Yes.
Thank you, Doc, for taking my question. Even though you've concentrated mostly on stroke victims tonight, my question has to do with ADHD and where you talked about the therapy, intense therapy of 6 hours a day was able to make new neuron pathways. There's a lot of things that are being bombarded towards or focused towards the ADHD community, mostly from people like Lumosity and MindSpark and CogMed, 20 minutes a day on the computer doing these computer games, numbers forward and backward. And they claim that can work and change and even cure or greatly reduce ADHD. What is your opinion about that?
I don't know it well enough to comment. All I can say is that there have been some studies looking at whether mindfulness meditation can have any impact on ADHD. These, however, were in adults who had ADHD and who therefore might be better equipped to sit down and learn this mental training. You know, not to appeal to bad jokes, but you know, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? Well, only one, but the light bulb has to really want to change. You know, for some of these things, for some of these mental training interventions, I mean, it's hard. It's, you know, I don't mean to make it sound like, you know, you snap your finger and suddenly you can engage in mental training and be an adept meditator, especially if you have an illness such as OCD or depression, which I know we didn't talk about, Tourette's. Sometimes it does take medication just to get you over the hump where you can then benefit from the mental training. I'm sorry I don't know more about the CogMed and other ADHD things. Yes, we'll take on the right.
It was just along the same lines. I was curious to see that they said here that you can alter the brain chemistry by the mental activity you're talking about. So what, I mean, are there ways of...
Well, in the sense that the brain runs on chemicals that carry information from one neuron to the other. So I was using that to describe, that was an example of, for instance, in OCD, where learning to observe the OCD, the compulsions and obsessions, in a disinterested way, acted back so that the, what we might call, overactive chemistry in that circuit had been quieted. Often these days when people talk about brain chemistry, it's in conjunction with depression, which is often characterized as a disease of you know, a dearth of serotonin or something else. There have been mental training interventions for depression. Cognitive behavior therapy is really, you know, a form of mental training, and those have been shown to be as effective as medication, and they're also longer lasting and have a lower relapse rate. So that's another example where, again, sort of a mental intervention is able to act on the electricity and chemistry of the brain, if you will.
So you're saying, is it on? So you're saying that through meditation, that would actually change the chemistry in your brain?
Again, chemistry in the sense of which regions are active, yes. The patterns of activity. Yes.
I was wondering if you could comment on whether you've heard of any work being done with neuroplasticity and training and chronic pain syndromes, particularly severe headache syndromes or nerve pain syndromes.
I have not. I'm sorry. But as I'm thinking about it, let me just say one quick thing. In all of the examples where neuroplasticity has been harnessed to fix something, just to be simplistic about it, the scientists have identified how that something has gone wrong. Again, overactivity in the OCD circuit, or in the case of depression, underactivity in the left prefrontal cortex and overactivity in some of the emotional regions. Anyway, all these other things. In dyslexia, problem with auditory processing. So there's been a very specific identification of this brain circuit has gone off the rails somehow. So that's the first thing you need to do. Only then can you figure out what is the intervention that might fix it. So in the case of chronic pain, I'm sorry, I just don't know if the research has shown clearly enough what has gone wrong, because that would have to be the first step before anybody then tries to figure out, again, how do we fix that? I'm sorry, I just don't know. Yes.
So as you may know, Utah has some cultural quirks, for better and for worse. Utah unfortunately leads the nation in LGBT suicides for teenagers and young adults, and there is a pressure to participate in so-called reparative therapy, and I'm wondering how you would respond to people who might try and leverage neuroplasticity to say, see, if you're not changing, it's because you're not participating intensively enough or long enough, and that you need more and more of this.
There's absolutely a dark side to the message of neuroplasticity, and before I even get to your question, the perhaps the most obvious one is if you tell people that you, can change, that with the right mental training and the right mental activity, you can change your brain in a therapeutic, healthy way, then it's a really small step to blaming the victim. Then you look at people who continue to suffer from depression or OCD or any of the other things, and somehow it's their fault that they didn't harness their brain, their mind right to fix themselves. So I'll just say that, and I should have said it up front. One can only hope that that doesn't happen. And in answer to an earlier question where I described how just really, really hard it is to engage in some of these mental trainings, sometimes you need something to get you over the hump. So let's please not blame any victims. As far as changing sexual orientation, you know, I said at the beginning to look skeptically when something is described as hardwired, but there's a danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Scientists, neuroscientists had been too quick to say that all of these things cannot be changed, but it would be equally wrong to say, oh, well, then everything can be changed. You know, my prediction, and we can reassemble here in, you know, 20 years, is that there are just some aspects of being human, such as needing to sleep, approaching rewards and withdrawing from pain. There are just some things that are so basic to humanity as a species and to individuals that they're not going to be changed. And, you know, sexual orientation is awfully basic. But then I would also add what I mentioned in response to the question here. Conditions where neuroplasticity has been harnessed therapeutically, there's been first the identification, this thing has gone wrong. I mean, that doesn't exist in, you know, in sexual orientation. And then, of course, the bottom line is that these therapies have been shown to be ineffective. Lisa, whoever you think.
So I was wondering, you said that the Dalai Lama referred various monks or what have you to be studied. So I was wondering if the Dalai Lama himself has been studied, and if so, what kinds of studies were done and what were the results?
He has not been. He has visited the lab in Wisconsin and, you know, found it all very cool, but he himself has not yet let, you know, put the electrode net on or slid into the tube. But I don't know if anyone has ever asked him why, but he has not. Yes.
There's been a lot of interesting research on brain-based learning, and I was wondering whether there's anything that professors or teachers can do to help their students kind of engage in this kind of very effective neuroplastic learning that you know of.
I mean, you would think that that's really the most important application of some of this work. You know, not to diminish the importance of the medical therapeutic applications, but surely if we can understand how to affect what students, what learners take in with their brain and how they think about things. That has been a hope, however, for more years than I can count. The idea that, as you put it, brain-based learning, I mean, what else would learning be other than brain-based? But the, you know, neural-based learning, as they call it, and there are oodles of commercial products that purport to target that and offer that. And I certainly don't know any of them well enough to comment on them specifically. But what does seem to be the case is that this is still very much a work in progress. The one thing that seems indisputable, however, actually two things. One is how important attention is. And I'll give you just one teeny example of that. This is a monkey experiment. So as I was saying earlier, sensory things, you know, different sensory experiences can change brain mapping. So monkeys were given a bunch of auditory stimulation, and then sensory stimulation, similar to reading Braille. Only the one they paid attention to, and they were trained, you know, in various ways with bananas and other rewards, only the one they paid attention to changed their brain. So just to underline that, identical sensory input, something into their ears or something that they were feeling with their fingertips, only the one that they were paying attention to remapped the cortex. So clearly, attention, focus is not, you know, some thing that we made up. It has some kind of physical reality that translates in, it's the crucial ingredient to bringing about neuroplastic changes. So focus is crucial. And then the other thing that seems to be fairly robust is the importance of repetition for learning. And if you put those two things together, I mean, focus, attention, of course, comes when the kids, not just kids, anybody, is engaged. So however teachers are able to keep that engagement up should be all to the good. But again, the idea of neurally based learning has been an aspiration for at least 10 years and has just been very, very slow in coming. There's a journal called Mind, Brain, and Education, if you're particularly interested in this. It's a quarterly. And there are, you know, a few interesting studies in there every issue. But as you read them, the message you come away with is we're still kind of stumbling around in the dark here. Yes, sir.
Actually, my question has already been answered. Oh. I was going to ask on the same subject. However, I would like to recommend a book. It's called The Art of Changing the Brain. It's by James Zoll, a biochemistry professor. I'm not sure exactly which city, but anyway, fantastic book.
And, cool.
And I think for any educator, it's a wonderful resource.
Thank you.
And for parents as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. You mentioned attention and repetition, and so I know that you've paid attention to this. But you were asked about pain management and things like that. And I know that Jon Kabat-Zinn in his work, and he's done a lot of work with Richard Davidson and his colleagues, has done looked at pain management. And mindfulness does help, doesn't make the pain go away totally, but as far as pain management goes, he worked at the University of Massachusetts, the medical school there. And about 30 years ago, he met Richard Davidson, and they've been known each other since that time, and he's done that line of research.
So with mindfulness, people, as you say, the pain itself is not diminished, but they're able to process it, handle it better. They're able to say, oh, my knee is killing me, but that's...
I don't know exactly the details, but they are able to sort of let go of the pain and function in their life. The same book, I believe it's called The Catastrophe of Full Living, deals with stress management also. But as I said, he started the research. He and Richard Davidson met when they were in school together at MIT, not yesterday.
Thank you.
Yes.
Would you comment, please, on mental intervention as a treatment for PTSD?
Well, there has been some success there. PTSD has been shown to be marked by a number of things, one of which is a shrinkage of the hippocampus. And that's a region of the brain that is involved in forming memories, but it's also involved in figuring out your context, your surround. And as you think about some of the ways PTSD manifests itself, that makes sense. For instance, I mean, the sort of cliched example is that you are a member of the military back home and you hear a car backfiring and suddenly, you know, you're on the streets of Baghdad again. So that's a context problem. You're not able to tell that you're in the safety of Salt Lake City, but instead you're in a dangerous war zone. One of the more successful interventions for PTSD has been to slowly bring the person to the place where the traumatic memories were formed. And this has also been done with victims of crimes. And let me use that example because it's a little bit easier. Let's say someone was attacked on a dark street somewhere. You don't bring her to the dark street at midnight, you know, the first time, but you might, therapists have had success with slowly bringing that person, let's say in broad daylight, to a block away from where it happened. And then, anyway, slowly teaching the brain that that one place is not a source of terror anymore. And similarly with military, with members of the military who are suffering from PTSD, there has been some success, again, sort of reintroducing them to whatever the trigger of their PTSD in a safe environment. So now they reprocess, in the earlier example, sudden sounds in a safe environment, and the sound is no longer associated with, oh my God, I'm under attack. So there, in fact, the power of the brain to change has been harnessed in a therapeutic way. Two more questions.
I have a question. I'm trying to understand the difference between the kind of mindfulness of meditation and a kind of intentionality and focus over time. And what made me think about it is I know a young man who had ADHD, and what sort of brought him out of it was a determination to be a pilot, in which focus had to be very intense, in which training was over a period of time. He's now a commercial pilot. So what is, you know, what is that intentionality over time? Is that different from that mindfulness?
Yeah, but they're not mutually exclusive. I mean, mindfulness is a way of observing yourself disinterestedly. So if, for instance, you are somebody who has trouble with focus, and if you practice mind, I should put an asterisk here. I myself don't meditate, so I'm just, you know, describing it the best I can based on the research and people I've spoken to. But I sort of don't want to meditate as long as I write about it, because then I sort of figure I'll be compromised. Anyway, so, you know, you can observe your lack of focus and say, oh shoot, there's my mind wandering again. I mean, people have had success in applying mindfulness to attention problems, both clinically diagnosed ADHD and just more, you know, gosh, I wish I could pay attention better. As to how you train yourself to really be sort of laser focused, Davidson argues that attention is an emotional style. And he thinks that there are ways to, you know, train it through, again, mental training, some meditation, but other avenues as well. That's probably not very helpful, but sorry.
Maybe this is an aside, but what are the effectiveness of pharmacological placebos or any other type of brain trickery into maybe pain management or anything else? Do you address that in your book?
I've addressed it. I addressed in the last book, not the current book on emotions. Placebo effects are real. If you believe something is going to help you, then it reduces your level of stress hormones. It can increase the levels of dopamine in your brain. People with Parkinson's disease have been helped with placebo pills. You know, for the longest time, both the medical community and the rest of us thought that the placebo, okay, you know, maybe it would work with, you know, sort of like namby-pamby conditions like pain or even depression maybe, but not something really, really hardcore like Parkinson's disease. But it does. And it drives the pharmaceutical industry crazy, because if you have to compare, no, if you have to compare a new medication to placebo, okay, so, you know, here's like fixing people, and if placebo is already up here helping people, your drug has to be pretty darn good to be better than the placebo, and a whole lot of them aren't, and, you know, there goes $1 billion in drug development money. No, that's a lovely thought to end on, because placebo truly does show the power of the mind. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you, Sharon. Thanks again to our sponsors. And again, I want to remind you, April 3rd, we have Radio Lab. If you have tickets, we'll see you at the museum. If you don't, listen to it on KCPW. Good night.